You are listening to the Valeo Mentis podcast.
On this episode, you'll meet Dr. Alicia Crandall, board-certified surgeon at Fairfield Equine Associates. We discuss her vet school experience, working in Australia, her journey to board certification, her surgical room environment, effective communication, and much more.
Here on Valeo Mentis, the goal is to shrink the veterinary world by connecting people together through stories and helpful resources. So listen closely and enjoy.
How's it going?
It's good. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good. Good. To be honest, today was a day off, but not for me because I have kids. So I was here with the kids. So I've been, had like a 3-day weekend, but not, I wasn't skiing in Vermont. So let's change the focus on you. How was that?
It was really fun. We had a bluebird day on Saturday up at Stowe. And then we had 5 inches Saturday night with the storm that was coming in.
Wow.
Which was amazing. And the lighting was just right. And I think in the couple hours we were able to ski before we had to head home, we had another 5 inches. So it was perfect.
Mm. Sounds like,
and then driving home was another story, but we made it.
Were you sledding back on ice? Or
basically, yeah. I was joking that my Volvo was basically just a snowmobile the whole way back.
Oh my gosh, that's scary.
Yeah, that's scary. But I'm used to it. I lived out west a fair bit too, so I'm no stranger to driving in the snow, unfortunately.
Stowe, I'm pretty sure I've skied at Stowe at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're East Coast skiers, but John's, you know, lives in Montana now.
Yeah.
But you have an Epic Pass?
I do have an Epic Pass, yeah. And I'm actually going to get to use that. So I leave for Switzerland this weekend. So I'm going to take a week and go hang out with my family over in Andermatt.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Awesome. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've done the Alps, but when I was 9. So
yeah,
it was awesome. But yeah, that's fun. So you're a snowboarder?
I'm a snowboarder, yeah. So I've snowboarded since I was 12. Again, we lived out west for a long time growing up. So I actually learned how to snowboard when we lived in Alaska. And then we lived down in Idaho and Colorado, so, and Utah. So I've gotten to ski most of the west. So this is actually my first year skiing on the East Coast.
Sorry about that.
You lived in like all the coolest places.
How
are you in Alaska?
My dad used to fly for the Air Force, so we moved around a lot growing up, and Alaska was one of the places we were stationed at for a couple of years.
Yeah, so you were probably at Hill Air Force Base in Utah.
In Utah, that's just where they've been since they retired. So my parents have a place in Midway, which is just south of Park City. For the past,
ever heard of it
or so.
what a ski! That's like a ski heaven right there.
Yeah.
That's definitely amazing.
It's Dr. great. Crandall, I remember.
She's just gonna name drop the whole time.
Yeah.
Get ready. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
No, that's awesome. I'm old enough. I should just say I'm so old that when I started skiing, snowboarders weren't even allowed on the mountain. And the snowboarders wore Airwalks and they shopped at Fishbone. They were the skaters that kind of, they all like hung out right over the next hill. But they've really gotten classy, you know, they've really classed it up over the years.
Yeah. Now they have
more respect. And
some of us turn into okay people.
They were the fringes of society. Then they turned the equine veterinarians.
Exactly.
Awesome. What other things do you like to do? Like for fun.
For fun, like not working?
Yeah, not working.
Because I really like working. snowboarding, I really like anything in the winter. That's probably the number one thing I'm doing. Other than that, I really like to hike and basically do anything outside.
Nice. Any name drops for hiking?
I feel like you have like the inside scoop on this.
How many 14ers have you been up? How many 14ers?
I can one up the 14ers. Midway through my residency, I was lucky enough. My dad wanted to go hike Kilimanjaro with some of his friends from work. So I was able to work out with my schedule during my residency program to be able to take a couple of weeks off and do that. And that was a once-in-a-lifetime trip to get to go to Africa. And it was a 9-day adventure. So you have to be guided to go up there. So we went with this amazing guide group. And there was 6 of us. So I was the only girl. I'm going to preface that out there. I was the only girl. And I did this journey with like 6 retired fighter pilots too.
Awesome.
Fearless.
Yeah. Kept up with everybody. And it was great. The company that we went with was phenomenal. And they were just all incredible people with amazing stories. And we spent 7 days going up the mountain and then 2 days coming back down. And it's something that I reflect back on frequently. It was beautiful.
Yeah. That's awesome. Sounds really neat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you do anything besides climb Mount Kilimanjaro when you were in Africa? Should you do like?
But no, I was on a pretty tight-knit schedule.
Yeah, I could only imagine.
Like, it was right at the end of second year of residency, so I'd already taken a month off to study for boards. And it was like right as we were coming into the summer, because we did it in June. So it was like right when we're supposed to be training new interns and coming into like being a third year and taking on senior call. So I was very creative and had some really great co-residents. So we were able to like perfectly craft the schedule where I essentially like red-eyed over to Africa. And then I think I was there for a day and we hiked. And then when we came back through, I think I had an extra day or two in Doha before coming back to the States. So.
So I bet none of those fighter pilots had a schedule that tight.
No.
So
probably not.
Got them.
Yeah, definitely. Every night they would put an SpO2 monitor, you know, like the one when you go to the doctor on your finger. Because every night they need to make sure that you're perfusing appropriately and that you're not too affected by the altitude. Which I am naturally a very competitive person. So of course I was always really excited when I always had the highest SpO2 every night as we came in. Yeah.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah, especially for guys who flew around in airplanes basically blacking out half the time.
Yeah.
Trying not to black out. Yeah, it's impressive.
Yeah. I think I had the advantage because they all were coming from sea level. And I had just finished studying for boards. And so I snuck away to Utah to study for boards. And so I was secretly like hiking and practicing and getting in shape for it right before.
You sit here, sandbagger. Okay. Right on. Anything. Hey, I think it's pretty cool that you prepared yourself. I bet they were proud too.
Yeah. It was a great trip, and I'm really glad I got to do that for my dad. So
yeah, you got to take advantage of these things when you can.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
amen.
Amazing opportunities. I'm curious. Do you have an equine background, or did that come later? So tell me.
I do. So my grandparents had a ranch in Central Valley, California, growing up. So even though we were military and moving around frequently, that was home base for us.
Wow.
In between moves, and we went back there frequently every summer. So I was a horse crazy kid for sure. And then once I was in middle school, we inherited a couple of horses because they downsized and sold the ranch. And so we had a couple of horses follow us around to moves. So I have some great parents who in hindsight were crazy to just say, you know, our 10-year-old is horse crazy. So we're going to keep a couple horses with us and we're going to move them from North Carolina to Texas to Alaska and then all the way back down again.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Your parents were smart. Small price to pay.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I grew up with horses and it's just something that's, you don't want to take for granted. Were you Western then or English? What was your...
I learned how to do both, but I did predominantly ride Western all the way up through college. I really stuck with the ranch horses and had a cutting horse trainer when I lived in College Station that I got to ride with.
Nice.
And that was a nice outlet in college.
Nice. So you were competitive? You got into that a little bit?
Just more for fun. Yeah.
Okay.
That's interesting. Right. Do you work on a lot of Western discipline horses where you are now?
Basically, no.
Yeah?
No. We have a couple, but it's not the overwhelming majority of what we do now are English sport horses.
Right. That's really interesting. So do you feel in any way that your Western background helps you in the English side? Or, I mean, I guess a horse is a horse. They move differently, but...
They do move differently. I think with the background that I had, I was exposed to a lot more of the breaking and the horse handling and the horsemanship side, which I think where at least I was in Texas, that was emphasized pretty strongly. And so I think that made me more readily able to adapt to working with all sorts of horses. Because for me, it wasn't necessarily as much about what a horse does individually. It's more just the horse as an athlete as a whole. And so I knew as I've gone through this journey, you know, I wasn't stuck on just wanting to work on Western performance horses or just wanting to work on race horses. You know, I really appreciated, one, the business side of the industry, but also being able to help people accomplish what they want to do with their horses and help them be the best athlete possible. And so I've been fortunate enough that that journey has led me to where I am here, where we get to work on some of, you know, the best sport horses that we have in the industry.
Yeah, that makes complete sense to me. And I was thinking that if you got a lot of exposure to horse breaking and colt starting, like your groundwork is probably pretty phenomenal. And I would imagine that having that in your pocket and being able to handle a horse on the ground at a competent level probably instills a ton of confidence in the people that your clientele that you're dealing with out there. Like they can see you can handle a horse well on the ground and know how to handle it yourself. It probably makes them pretty happy.
Yeah, definitely. And I think handling horses, I've learned, in a veterinary environment is so much different than in the barn. And I think as I've learned that more and learned how to communicate that to clients better, I think that's helped us be able to accomplish things or, you know, potentially help owners, you know, who maybe are recalcitrant about bringing an animal into the clinic, overcome that barrier and feel more comfortable with it. And being able to explain to them, you know, how we're able to have more control in the clinic. And, you know, I am lucky enough to have a great team of technicians who are all skilled horse handlers, and we're able to have control of the environment from the beginning. Rather than, you know, maybe the horse being at the barn and the owner's teenage kid is holding the horse in one hand and on the phone in the other hand, and not really paying attention. And so I think that makes it safer for us and safer for the horses too, and hopefully allows us to get a better outcome for an owner.
Yeah, there's probably a lot less corgis running under horses in your clinic than there.
It depends. I don't know. At New Bolton, there were definitely plenty of corgis, right?
John used to call him New Bolton.
Yeah.
Once we're part of time.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Is Teener Sweeney still there? Dr. Sweeney?
The Sweeneys retired just after I started my internship there. I think when COVID started, they started, but like retire with like quotation marks on it. I think they were still, you know, they're still at every major meeting and, you know, social gathering that we have. So they're still very important to our community there.
Yeah. You probably worked really closely with David then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. David was my mentor and still a very good friend.
Oh, wow. That's lucky you.
Yeah, definitely. I remember. So he was my like actual mentor. And when you start the internship, you know, you're rotating through medicine and surgery and critical care and ultrasound and all these different departments. But when you go, you know, you don't have very long before you have to start applying to the match and you have to start asking people for letters of recommendation. And sometimes based on your rotations, you may not be even seeing anybody in the surgery department for months. And so you have to be pretty forward about going out and talking to people. And when they wanted you to assign, when they wanted you to find a mentor, they wanted you to find somebody who was in the department you were interested in. And I think I had spoken with Levine maybe once or twice. And then I just saw him in the hallway and I was like, hey. And he was like, hey. And I was like, I need a mentor. And I was like, will you be my mentor? And he was like, yeah, of course, whatever.
Just had to acquire him.
Yeah. Yeah. And that ended up working really well. So, you know, we had the same mentality and both are very business minded about things. So that led to some great, you know, lessons and conversations as a resident.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Yeah.
Let, Yeah, let's back up to college. So what made you choose veterinary medicine? Obviously, the passion for the horses, was that it? I mean, that you just knew.
Yeah, that was it.
At what age did you know?
So I remember being in middle school, and obviously very horse crazy, and having conversations with my parents about, you know, what do you want to do with your life? And I was very interested in math and science. And so I remember my parents threw out the idea of becoming a veterinarian because that was a way to be involved with horses, but also, you know, still potentially play to my strengths. And at that time, we lived in Texas, and every April, A&M does an open house with a vet school. And I remember going to that and actually listening. It's funny. So I remember listening to the talk, and Bo Brock was doing a talk there. I don't know if you guys have ever heard.
Yeah, I'm reading his book right now.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah. He's a great speaker, a great storyteller. And it's funny in hindsight because one of his daughters, Abby, was in my graduating class from A&M. Oh, wow. And we actually became board certified surgeons within a year of each other. So I got to see full circle of that come back, you know, somebody who inspired me to go to vet school. And, you know, then his daughter and I ended up becoming both board certified surgeons together. So that was pretty great.
It is great.
So once I, you know, after that weekend, I was pretty dead set on not just being a vet, but going to A&M. And everything just happened to work out really well from that. I think part of it came from being very focused and, you know, knowing that's what I wanted to do. And I think that helped me tremendously because with moving a bunch, it would have been really easy to fall behind because so much falls off of prerequisites and, you know, getting in somewhere. And so having that focus from the get-go, I think saved some time. So, you know, I started high school in Alaska and only did 1 year of high school in Alaska and then ended up going to Idaho. And we knew we were in a 2-year assignment in Idaho. And so then we had to figure out, if I'm trying to go to Texas A&M, is it easier to graduate early and do a year of college and then transfer into A&M? Or do I try applying to A&M as a senior in high school who's at their third high school and has no activities, no leadership, nothing, because I would have been brand new there. And so what we ended up figuring out was to just get high school done in 3 years. And so that's what I did. And then we moved to Colorado after Idaho. So I just did my first year of college at Colorado State Pueblo and worked with some people down there to make sure whatever classes I took were likely to transfer into A&M, transferred into A&M after a year. And then was down in Texas for like a total of 9 years for school and everything.
Wow. So I'm a pony. So SMU, we got the pony years.
Yeah.
We've got the, UT is Hook'em Horns, right?
Yeah. We don't.
And we got the Red Raiders.
Yeah.
The Red Raiders. So
thumbs up, guns up.
Yeah. So what are the Aggies? What's your
Gig'em Aggies?
Gig'em Aggies. Now what's
Gig'em Aggies? It's the thumbs up, but
it's like, just a thumbs up.
No, so it's just the thumbs up, but it's because like you're supposed to be holding a spear to gig frogs because it comes from the days when Texas A&M and Texas Christian were at the same conference. So then you would gig frog.
Wow. What's a horned frog anyways? Like,
what is a horned frog?
Precious, like, apparently.
Technically, I think they're horny toads, right? Like, that's what we would call them in Texas.
Well, I'm
even call
horned,
them
horned toads.
Well, we're not big fans of TCU from SMU, but
there you go. Somebody gigs a frog, they bring it to you, they sew it up, and you sew it up. That's it. You win both ways.
You would never sew up a horned.
That's it.
No.
That's why they have a vet school there.
That's where she draws the line. That's where she draws the line.
They no horned frogs, no longhorns.
Was it hard to be at such a big school and in a college in that environment and still in vet school? Was it kind of segregated and just kind of head down, or did you get the full experience, or did you feel like you...
yes, I would say I got the full experience. I loved A&M. I like wear the ring. I obviously can recite any of the cult, you know, it puts the cult in culture, right? You know, when I went to Texas A&M, I went to something called transfer camp. So you go in the middle of the woods for 3 days and you learn all the traditions and
bells
And anyone, most people from Anna will have done a similar thing when they're freshmen, but they call it fish camp when you're a freshman. Like you can see in the war hymn, there's a lot of great and crazy traditions that go along with being at Annam, and I drank the Kool-Aid and bought into all of it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so, that makes me happy.
If you're ever lost in the woods, someone will know it's an Aggie, right? If it's another Aggie, like you'll be able to find each other.
Yeah, exactly. One, because they're probably going to say something about it, and two, they probably have the ring.
Yeah.
Wow. That's cool. What were some experiences? What were some hands-on opportunities you had in college? Did they have a lot of horses at that school?
So A&M had two pre-vet tracks. So you could either go through the College of Agriculture through animal science, or you could go through the College of Vet Med and go through a biomedical science program. And I went into the animal science program because it was impressed as a more hands-on program and as a potentially better program if you were interested in large animal medicine. So A&M has a horse herd. A&M has multiple horse herds. You know, they have the equestrian team. They have the cavalry. They have a polo. Horse. Huh?
They have polo, right?
Yeah, they have polo. Yep. They have just their general, you know, breeding stock. So it was kind of cool because as a student, you can take classes where we're foaling out mares, and then you're taking care of those foals in a different class the next year. And then there's a class on actually breaking, like you get college credit for like learning how to break a horse.
Wow.
And learning how to, you know, ride young horses, and that those horses support the department because they will do like an auction, I think when they're like 3 and 4 year olds, or they, you know, stay in the riding program, or they'll go to the stock horse team or something like that. So they can stay within the system for multiple different uses, which is pretty cool. So that was a good experience to get. And then from, you know, having the benefit of the vet school being right there too, we had plenty of opportunities to shadow within the vet school or shadow with local vets. Or like what I ended up doing was I wanted to do a breeding internship before I went to vet school. So I was supposed to graduate in the spring, but I really wanted to do a breeding internship. So I stacked on a couple extra summer classes and dropped my minor and finished up in the fall. And so then I went out to the 4.6s and worked a breeding season out there before I started vet school.
Fun.
Another name drop. Wow.
Okay, that wasn't a name drop before the TV show.
Oh, you worked on the force. I know. John lives in a TV show right now. He kind of wishes it never happened for where he lives, but we won't talk about it.
Is Dr. Blodgett still at 4.6s when you were there?
He was, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. It was, in hindsight, it was such an incredible opportunity, the amount of time and just, again, going back to simple things like horse handling and handling foals and handling yearlings, you know, that get all sorts of crazy wounds out in their pen. And you know, that's kind of where I realized I, you know, really enjoy emergencies, and I maybe enjoy repro and really enjoyed working, you know, with foals and all these mares. You know, we get mares that would colic and then they would go off to Dr. Brock to get colic surgery. And I always felt sad when I was stuck at the farm and they're all going off to get surgery. So it was cool because I think that led me into realizing, or even before starting vet school, what I didn't like, and not everyone has those opportunities until they're much further along in the process.
Yeah. Helping narrow things down. When did you decide you wanted to be a surgeon?
Went into it, I guess part of it came from the fact that, you know, you just don't know, and depending on what your shadow experience is, what different people do, right, as their vets. And so part of, you know, what intrigued me about being a vet was, you know, getting to do colic surgery. And gained to do arthroscopy. And as I went down that path and, you know, learned more about the difference between being a general practitioner who does equine versus like a large animal practitioner versus somebody who's a specialist, I realized the things I was really interested in were things that were being done primarily by board certified surgeons. And so that was where that, you know, interest came into play. And that was probably about halfway through vet school. I was kind of getting all those pieces put together, which was good because then that gave me 2 years to kind of get my GPA sorted back out for residency applications.
Right. Yeah, that's cool.
What's the process of getting board certified? I'm, I, I know nothing about this.
Yeah, so it's kind of cool. You know, when human medicine, you have to go through a match, right? You have to be assigned to some sort of specialty program, or else you can't just go out and be a doctor. Whereas in vet medicine, you know, once you pass your national boards and then you take state boards for wherever you want to practice, you can go out and you can be a general practitioner, and you can work on whatever sort of animals you want. And in the equine world, it's fairly standard, you know, for people to try to do an internship, again, because most of what you're learning in vet school is applied across all species. And even with some specialization, you know, you just aren't getting your reps in and you aren't seeing day in and day out what you would in an internship. And if you were going out on your own, you know, and having to also be a businessman and, you know, grow your own clientele, you may not get the same experience and exposure you would want one year out as a doctor. So it's not required to do an internship, but a lot of people who go into equine medicine do try to find an internship program that matches with what their goals are and what they want to do as a doctor. And after that internship, if you want to specialize further, then you can try to match into a residency program. And so there's a website where people can submit applications to then essentially match into a residency program. And they can do that, you know, for surgery, for internal medicine, for theorio, for anesthesia. And there are, you know, primarily academic-based surgery residency programs out there. There are some that are private practice based. They're few and far between, and they're usually geared for people who did an internship at that practice and then, you know, are intending to stay on there. So those are usually, you know, applications that are performed out of the match. But so I had entered the match. I tried after my first year as an intern. So I did a private practice internship out in California. Applied for the match, did not get a match in. And part of that came from, you know, what they look for in an application. Some of that is experience, and some of that is, you know, a little bit of, did you go to school here? Do we know you? Do we not know you? And some of that comes down to research too, and being able to show, you know, part of your requirements for being a resident is getting a research paper in and then doing some other educational parts within the program, and they want to make sure that you're a good fit for that side too. So it's not uncommon for people who do a private practice internship first to need academic internship second to balance that out. So after my first internship, I ended up getting a second internship at the University of Pennsylvania's New Bolton Center, and then ended up matching and staying there for my residency program.
Hmm.
So for me, the journey after school was 5 years. To become, like, to get into a residency program and then eventually become a board certified surgeon. Some people are able to get in after just one internship if they had a really good relationship with their program when they were their vet student. You know, sometimes if you're a really good student at a school and then you do an internship and you come back, some people will do that after 1 year. Some people, just based on, you know, where you go for your internships and, you know, maybe other life things happen, you know, sometimes you're out for 3 or 4 years and then you come back and you do a residency.
So completing your residency, right? And then entering the career field. What was that like? Because right now, obviously, people with your skill set are extremely in demand, I would think. People are trying to hire veterinarians all over the place. So what was that like for you? Was that your experience? And why, how did you wind up in the Northeast?
I love being a surgeon. I'm just going to put that out there. It's very satisfying to have something that you worked hard for so long be exactly what you thought it is. And you know, and I'm really lucky to be in the opportunity that I'm in now, and working with a great group of people who support me, and I in turn, you know, support our cause. And it's really nice to see everything click. But I know that that's not the experience for everyone. And that wasn't even, you know, my initial experience. You know, when I came out of residency, my initial thought was like, this is my chance. You know, this is almost like me graduating. You know, it was, I feel like after vet school, I knew I just had more steps that I needed to take. So becoming a vet was great. That was a life goal that I wanted to, but it was just the next step in the process. You know, I knew I needed to do internships to get to a residency to then pass the test and become a board certified surgeon. And so whereas I think a lot of classmates that I had, you know, saw vet school as their big, you know, finishing one thing and moving on to the next part of their life, I didn't really have that for the first 5 years. Even though I was a vet, I was still working towards something else. And so I feel like I'm essentially at the start of my career and, you know, having all those avenues in front of you, it's really cool. And it's good to finally be able to step up, you know, into a position within the industry and not just be like, oh, I'm just a trainee, or, oh, I'm just here for a year, or I'm just here for a couple years. Like, it should finally be moving on to the next step has been really great.
Right. So how did you wind up deciding on where you are now? What drew you to that?
I originally was not coming this direction. I, right after residency, had found a position actually in Australia. And thought, again,
picking our language.
Yeah.
Add me a Vegemite sandwich, because
All right.
On the same wavelength. Yeah. That didn't work out though, huh?
Yeah, it was once I got over there, and it just wasn't from what I wanted to try to accomplish with my career. I realized it just wasn't quite lining up. But it was a perfect opportunity for somebody who was right out of residency, who wanted to get a lot of surgeries done, be in a really busy practice, and just get to see how, you know, medicine, there's obviously different styles of medicine, and there's a spectrum of care that we talk about, right? You know, not everybody is going to be able to afford or accomplish the same things. And some of it's based on culture, and some of it's just based on what's available. You know, there's times, and it's something that we, I think, take advantage of every day. Simple things, you know, like us even being able to have fluids or certain drugs, or just, you know, drug companies that, you know, you have a relationship with and you can order things from. That's not a universal thing internationally. And so I'm really glad I was able to have the experiences that I did overseas and get to see something new and get to say I lived in Australia for 6 months and, you know, study for my last test for boards, you know, on like Bondi and Coogee Beach. Like, that was phenomenal.
I should play a game here. We're gonna guess where in Australia she was, and I think Ryan, you should go first. Now, she already said Bondi, but that doesn't, you know, you can get the Bondi from anywhere.
It's near Sydney.
Yeah,
I went there on my honeymoon.
What?
Yeah. I've been to Bondi Beach.
Yeah,
I've seen things as a 20-year-old male that I was like, that. It, you know what I mean? It was shocking.
Was it?
I've been to Bondi. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So
I'm just wondering, what's going to be your guess where she was? Because I have a pretty good idea.
Where on Bondi Beach?
My
LinkedIn.
We will later.
You live near Bondi. That's where the practice was? Near there?
No more questions. You have to guess.
Question.
Okay. Yeah, Ryan. You have to guess now. And whoever's closest gets the win.
I don't understand.
Sydney, where's she in?
She's in Sydney. There's Sydney.
Is that your guess?
Well, that's where Bondi Beach is.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But you can get to Bondi from anywhere.
Oh.
I don't think it was Sydney. I'm gonna say it was Scone.
Scone.
No, that's the Hunter Valley. No.
That's not even close.
That's the Hunter Valley.
Both of y'all are off. I was actually up in Queensland.
Oh, okay. See?
All right, hold on.
Okay.
Warwick. If you say Warwick, my head's gonna explode. Not Warwick. No.
Nope.
So you were near the beach, Brisbane?
Brisbane. Yeah, I was just south of Brisbane in like a little town called Bow Desert.
Okay.
That sounds heavenly.
I played I've been there for pole across, and I played pole across at the Gold Coast Carnival, which was
in
Brisbane.
Yeah.
Next to a football field. It's a huge sport over there. It's kinda like in polo, you've got the Argentines, and this is their, you know, that's where their mecca is. While Australia is that for me, a lot of Bundaberg rum, my favorite.
I've got 6 bottles of Bundy at my house for Ryan. I don't drink.
Real?
You get it from Canada.
I go to Canada to get it. I drive up there, and well, I guess I shouldn't say that on here, but I've been bootlegging booze from Canada for quite some time.
And Tim Dan's.
Yep.
Oh, I love this tangent. All right. So exactly. tell me about Australia, what you enjoyed about it. You say it medicine's different. So you didn't have access to everything that you do here, right? So just talk about Australia and working there.
The country's beautiful, and they have a great work-life balance, which, again, as somebody who really wants to work, it was definitely very balanced, but I also felt like I was stressed by not working enough. Mm. But I thought the beaches were phenomenal, and it's, you know, everywhere you go somewhere different, you always try to relate back to what's familiar with you, and I was fortunate enough to live in several different places, and you know, we lived in England for a little bit when I was younger, so like I was used to traveling internationally and you know, not always being comfortable with home, and so I really liked getting to see it and try to, you know, you're trying to compare back to what you know, but getting to appreciate it for why it was different. And so I loved the cities over there. I loved the culture of people and just how kind and nice everybody was. Just how open they were to traveling and, you know, just doing things outside and having a great appreciation, you know, for their local wildlife and nature was amazing. I will say for an English speaking country, I felt like we never were saying the same thing ever. I remember I didn't realize how much of, as being a vet, that was going to be a barrier. Like I remember doing a gastroscopy with a client. And the horse had terrible ulcers. And so I'm trying to talk to them about feed recommendations and medications and all these things. And they're just looking a little lost. And I wrote it off as just me being an American. I don't know. And so they eventually left it. And the technician, after they left the room, was just like, yeah, so this alfalfa hay you're talking about.
It's chaff.
What is the lucerne over
yeah,
there?
Lucerne.
Yeah. And so there's so many things, even just from a medicine side, you had to learn that were different based on what they did and didn't have from an availability standpoint. And so, and, you know, especially when you get thrown in an emergency situation and you're just trying to think of what you know, but then you're like, oh, but you call it something different. Or, you know, over there, one of the big things is one of their penicillin brands that they have is called Depocillin. But they would just refer to it as Depo, which in the U.S., Depo is not the same.
Whole different thing.
Wow. Exactly. Yeah. So just overcoming what you wouldn't have thought would be a language barrier that definitely challenged you and challenged your patience, which, you know, I stay true to the surgeon mentality where I don't pride myself on having a ton of patience.
Yeah.
So,
I think the thing that I appreciated the most about Australians is their unbelievable ability to understate almost everything. Like, and I wouldn't even call it modesty. Like, it's like, I think it comes from politeness, like that English influence of always being polite. And I remember if something was just like god awful and terrible, they would just say it was ordinary. They'd be like, it's fairly ordinary. And I'd be like, what are you talking about? It sucks. Yeah.
Or I really did like, you know, they have a phrase over there that's just like, she'll be right. And I do kind of like that. Yeah. Especially with horses. That's like the best phrase to just have in your back pocket. Just like, because the horses will find every way for something to go wrong. And it's just nice. They would all, you know, they would be watching a horse flopping in front of your face and making a mess everywhere. And they're just like, ah, she'll be right. You're like, will she? Can we get somebody to, like, you know, sedate this thing, please?
Everything will work out. That's going to be the title of this episode. She'll be right.
She'll be right.
Yeah. Dr. Right.
Yeah.
It's coming.
Yeah.
I'm super fond of horsemen over there.
Me too.
They're amazing.
Best horsemen in the world, yeah.
And it's, you know, over here, there's some guys with accents. One I can name drop because we're family friends with Guy McLean. But there's some, you know, the Aussie accent isn't the only thing that's cool about these horsemen. No, they're phenomenal horsemen. And my family bred Australian stock horses. I have a full stock horse here and some crosses. Do you remember how hardy and tough those horses were compared to other horses?
No. I would see wounds and things over there that I would be like, oh, this thing's gonna die. And then they would be like, no, it's fine. I just want antibiotics. I'm gonna take it home. And you're like, okay, I guess I'll see you in 2 days when we're putting it down. And they would come back like 3 months later and they're like, look, doc, it's all healed up. It looks great. It's just like, this is not scientifically possible.
That's not what they said. They said, give me some of that dinky dye depot and I'll take it home. She'll be right.
She'll be right. So, like, and keep in mind, I went there straight from working at Penn. So,
oh,
like,
my God.
Pendulum, like, swung from one end to the other.
Complete different universes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. That's awesome. Like,
what is this evidence-based medicine that you're talking about? Like, your paper says this, but, like, I've done this for 30 years, so. It was really good to see, you know, what horses are capable of in all aspects of it, you know? Yeah. And having, you know, even if it's an N of one, you know, an experience of, like, a single horse and being like, well, this one made it through, you know, it's always good to kind of see the random crazy cases and, you know, just what they can pull through.
Right. So it was Australia, then Penn, then where you are now.
Yeah, Penn, then Australia. And then I remember, I was like, so when we sit our boards for surgery, you take a test in the middle of your residency and then you finish your residency in July, but the second test isn't until February. And so it's not uncommon for people to try to take temporary jobs. And so that's kind of, you know, like when I went to Australia, it was like, you know, I'll go down, see what it's like, and then see if it's somewhere I want to stay. And that, you know, didn't shape out that way. So I just ended up taking my test and was, you know, looking for jobs while I was studying for boards. And the job at Fairfield popped up like a week before boards, maybe. And I reached out to some contacts and was like, I want to talk to Ryland. I want to talk to Kim. Like, you know, let's see if I can go here and if we can make this work. And I remember them reaching out and being like, well, isn't your test tomorrow? Like, should we talk about this later? And I was like, no, we can talk now. Yeah.
What year was that when you started there?
At Fairfield?
Yeah.
It was just last year.
Yeah. So
it's been a whirlwind.
Yeah. Yeah. Dang. You're at Fairfield. What was the reality of Fairfield compared to Penn as far as what you were working on? I mean, what's the difference between Penn and Fairfield? I'll just ask that.
Well, obviously one's a university hospital. So, you know, you're working with students every day. And then, you know, in private practice, we do get students through as externs. And, you know, we have interns in both places. But I think the one thing is the size of it. And so when you're working at Penn, you're working at this huge institution, right? So, you know, you have surgeons, you have internists, we have thyroidogenologists, we have ultrasonographers, we have cardiologists. You have, like, if you can think of specialty, like somebody is there and they have a fellow and residents and interns. And I loved that community there, because it was a teaching community from the top down, right? So, you know, we not only had fabulous nurses and technicians, but then we also had nursing students who were there. And then we had like our fourth year students. And we were able to essentially operate like a machine. You know, there's like 120 stalls there, maybe.
Wow.
And you're seeing horses and then you're also seeing farm animals, you know, like pigs and goats and cows and the occasional alpaca and camel. You know, and kangaroo. We did have kangaroos when I was there. So, you know, it was just a large operation with all these departments. And so every day was just sun up to sun down. You know, you're just doing as much as you can in the day. And in order to, you know, if you had a last minute add-on that needed surgery, it would be like, okay, we got to make sure radiology's on board. We got to make sure anesthesia's on board. We got to make sure the OR staff have room for it. And how are we going to fit it into the schedule? Whereas, you know, the nice thing about being in private practice now is if a horse comes in the morning and we see something and maybe it was just supposed to be an imaging case, but it turns out it needs surgery, I can just look at, you know, I can look at my technician and then I can like look at, you know, the girl who's in charge of our hospital and I can be like, we can do this tomorrow, right? And they'll just be like, yeah. And I'm like, great. Or even just like, we can do this today. Yeah, great. Like, you know, we'll add it in, you know, we'll squeeze it in. It's a lot easier because your team on every, you know, we're doing our own radiology and we're doing our own anesthesia. And, you know, my technician like runs all my anesthesia. And then, you know, the other technician that we have that runs our hospital, she's our OR nurse. And so, you know, everyone's right there. And so we have a little bit of a better workflow or, you know, increased efficiency in the sense that, you know, if it needs to happen, we can make it happen today.
Yeah. It's kind of like a New York City apartment. You're in the kitchen and then you walk a step forward, you're in the bathroom or, you know, you're in the,
yeah,
the, yeah, it's all,
yeah,
everything's right there.
Mm-hmm.
And Fairfield is not a small referral hospital. So how many surgeons, I don't even know this answer, and I serve this hospital, but how many surgeons, you know, compared to ambulatory and techs? I mean, it's 40 to 50.
I think I'm going to inflate the number so that way we can get more cookies next time.
Go for it.
45 people who work there total. So I'm the second surgeon. So Rylan Edwards had been the surgeon here, or is still a surgeon here. And is an incredible mentor and person to work with. So I joined him on as the second surgeon. And then I'm going to have to like count out the offices on my head. So he makes up one of five partners within the practice. And then there is myself. And then there are three other associate doctors that work up in Connecticut full time. And then we have two veterinarians who work out of Wellington, Florida, throughout the whole year. And then we have four interns on top of that. And everybody has their own technician. And then we have a couple imaging technicians, you know, between pharmacy, the front desk, everybody. It's like, it's a whole team. And it's crazy how you can, you know, out of may have a group of 40 to 50 people, still make them all feel like family really good.
Mm-hmm. So for a colic surgery, how many techs are working that? I'm just trying to get an idea of the numbers.
Yeah.
So
at a minimum, you can get a colic surgery done with four people. We usually have closer to five to six. So we'll either have, you know, it goes during the day, which I love me a good daytime colic surgery. Like there's nothing better than it's just like 9 a.m., you finished your coffee, and the colic from the night before has decided it's going to just start flopping, and you're just like, okay, this is great. The whole team's here. Everybody's happy. We're just going to get this done. We're going to have to push off, you know, the case that I don't want to block today anyways. No, daytime colic surgery is great. So, you know, if it's happening in the daytime and even sometimes at night, you know, my primary technician will run anesthesia. And then we have somebody else in the hospital who will be our OR nurse, and then I'll scrub in with an intern. And then if we're doing something more involved, like an enterotomy, sometimes we'll pull in another technician or another intern to help do that just because, so just for perspective, an enterotomy is referring to, you know, when we're doing colic surgery, sometimes horses have impactions in their large colon. And so imagine this tiny 5'6" girl pulling out this 8-foot colon of a horse, putting it on a separate table, and then opening it up so that way you can use a combination of hoses inside of the colon to help break up the impaction. And that's something that definitely needs like four sets of hands
Wow.
in order to do successfully. And so there's a lot going on and there's water running everywhere and there's just like manure coming out of a colon and it's loud. You know, I usually have music bumping in the background too. So it gets loud and a little chaotic, but it's super fun.
What kind of music?
That's a great question. I really am a huge fan of the Spotify Deist, or Daylist is what they call it. So it changes a little bit every day. And they always have crazy names. So like this evening, it's nostalgia throwback pop Monday evening.
A-list.
You know, sometimes we'll have classic rock in there. We'll have a lot of like dance music in there too. You know, the Bad Bunny album just came out a couple weeks ago. So that it's a little bit of everything.
I like the variety.
Yeah, so nobody is ever able to guess what I'm going to play.
So
keep them guessing. Keep them excited. No, I was going to say, just a real quick comment, but I think we're going to say that enterotomy is going to be the most inspiring of all the veterinary of all the veterinary procedures you can do, that when people see that, they're like, oh, they're either like, I want to be a equine vet, or they're like, I don't want anything to do with that. I'm just going to say that. I was going to say that now. I mean, this is, yeah. Ryan and I are just getting started at this, but the amount of people that are going to tell us the first time they saw that they wanted to be a veterinarian, I'm going to be like, it's adding up.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It's impressive.
And I guess you don't have to worry about the horses because they're out, but everyone just kind of has to adapt to whatever you're playing, right? Because there are some people that they don't handle the loud noises and the stressful things. So it's just kind of interesting how everyone kind of has to just mold together. So I guess what I'm trying to ask is, how do you deal with the stress of a surgery, of chaos going on? You know, you might feel like you're short staffed, you're waiting for someone else to come, more hands. How do you handle that?
For me, the surgery is almost the chill zone or the quiet zone. Like, you know, again, it's everything's stressful up until it, but then surgery is surgery. You know, you kind of take the hits as they come, you know, with complications happening. You know, something's happening intraoperatively, something's bleeding that's not supposed to be bleeding. You know, in my mind, there's always a checklist going on and like, we need to do this, we need to do this. And how can I help explain to the intern, like how they can help best, and, you know, how if maybe I told them to pull this way and it's not working great, you know, what can we do better? And just trying to problem solve that. And I find like a weird piece in that, I guess, because for me, all the stressful stuff is happening before surgery of, you know, like, let's say we're short staffed or we're crazy busy. And, you know, if you have a flopping colic and a million emergencies going on, the stress for me is like getting to the room. And then once we're in the room, then it's like, okay, I know this, I know how this is supposed to go and what's supposed to happen. And so that's a little bit of a better space for me to be in, at least like once we're scrubbed in or, you know, getting the horse ready for surgery. Everything's kind of a routine, and I genuinely love what we do. And so I try to like help that energy with everybody else, especially when it's 2 a.m. and, you know, obviously people are tired and maybe we already had a rough day and now we're back here with an emergency in the middle of the night. If you come at it with a good attitude, then everybody else is hopefully going to have a better time or a better outcome that night than they would have if you were, you know, sullen and like, oh, why we got to be here.
I heard some research on teams that were the most effective in surgery type situations and stressful situations, and it's not the ones that make the least amount of mistakes, it's the ones that have the most psychological safety, and they can report back and they can learn from their mistakes. So do you have those kind of meetings where you talk about what happened and what can be improved? And
yeah, I think we both on a small and a large scale, that was something that I really appreciated during my residency was, you know, we would have morbidity and mortality rounds, right? So every month we would get together and we would discuss difficult cases. And not necessarily cases, you know, where an animal died, but maybe an animal just had a less than what we expected outcome, or, you know, a difficult situation where maybe everybody wasn't communicating the best. And so that was something that we would have as a whole institution monthly, but even just after every surgery, it's like, okay, what went well? What didn't go well? What could we have done better? And most of the things come back to communicating before the operation, you know, and making sure everybody was available. And again, coming back down to the smaller scale of where I am in private practice, you're able to have those conversations a little bit more immediately. The technicians are, because we're all, you know, working so closely together, they're like, hey, we have the surgery tomorrow. What do you want to have for it? Let's make sure we have all the things we want sterilized for it. Or, you know, even planning something out a week or two ahead of time, making sure we have equipment ordered. I think that's all really important, but then also, you know, knowing the right time, if something didn't go well, when do you address it? Because sometimes it's best to address it in the moment, right? Because it's something that you don't want to happen in the near immediacy. And sometimes it's something that everybody needs to, you know, take a step back, kind of think about how the situation went, and then all approach it with a fresh mind and, you know, not necessarily having the quote unquote heat of it in the moment, and being able to take, you know, what potentially may have been heightened emotions because, you know, people were tired or, you know, hungry or frustrated or something like that. I think there's a huge benefit to, you know, coming back together with the team later and saying, hey, do we think this worked as well as we wanted it to? And if not, why? And genuinely, you know, when you do that, making sure that you're listening to everybody's input and that you're not just having that meeting for the sake of having the meeting.
This correlates to just relationships in general, but let me just kind of explain what I'm talking about. So when I think of veterinarians, especially surgeons and people in the medical field, they're highly intelligent. They're highly competitive typically because that's just, they grow up in an environment where academics are really important and they have to achieve. And so when you get into a situation where things don't always go perfectly, that's that high stress. And so being able to have that humility, number one, is like understand where other people are coming from, but, you know, not chew their head off in this that stressful moment. And then, you know, admitting that you did something wrong. Do you find it hard for some of the interns or the newer people to kind of speak up when you want them to speak up? Or is that just like building that relationship over time to make them confident in that?
Yeah, I think it's about building the relationship. I mean, I'm also not going to come on here and act like I'm perfect at it, right? And so I think a lot of it is just like coming down to your own self-awareness and, you know, realizing where you may have faltered in a situation. But I do think it's really important whenever we're bringing in younger doctors and new nurses and technicians on the team is like making sure that they understand that they can speak up. But you can't just say that, right? You do have to create those opportunities for them. And sometimes you have to start the conversation because sometimes it's going to be an awkward conversation. And so if you're the one who is willing to knock yourself down a peg or two and be like, hey, I realize I messed up on this. How do we make this better? And it's not always a perfect conversation. And sometimes you may stumble over it the first couple times. And then, you know, as they come up, then hopefully you're empowering others to help start those conversations too. Or, you know, at the very least, especially like where we are now, you know, we always emphasize that's patient first. So if there's anything that comes down to, you know, patient safety or patient outcome or anything like that, you know, we want to make sure everyone's empowered to speak up about that. And, you know, the cause behind whatever may have happened isn't what we're trying to address in the beginning. It's, you know, making sure that we're having an open conversation about it first so that way we can help the patient and then we can deal with the situation that maybe led to whatever the incident was later. And again, making sure that those two things are separated because, you know, if something like if you have like a poor outcome or you have an unexpected complication like overnight with a patient, you're not trying to communicate with the intern in that moment like this is how we need to prevent this in the future. You're trying to like help the patient out and right. Make sure that, you know, the interns are understanding that what they did was correct and like coming to you and seeking help. Because it's hard, you know, I definitely was in this boat myself. You know, when you're a new young doctor, you can feel like you have the weight of everybody on you and that you're expected to know everything. You don't know what you don't know. And so like making sure that you're still reaching out to people and reaching out for help, especially if something's not going right, that's hugely invaluable. And you're not going to know that all the right time or the first time perfectly. And so you got to always make sure that you're still asking for help. I still ask for help like all the time.
That's awesome. Well said. That's a big component of, we always ask people like what their advice would be to like younger veterinarians or people that are starting out. And I think you just nailed it. We only have to ask you.
Yeah.
I'm curious about compassion fatigue because that's a thing. You know, you're dealing with a lot of, you know, life and death. Things don't go right all the time. You're obviously having to talk to clients when things go wrong. So how do you handle all that, dealing with life in your hands all the time? Does it happen often enough that it weighs you down, or are you able to put it in a bucket and say, this is here and this is my personal life? And yeah, how do you handle all that?
I am good at putting things in buckets. And so I think struggle with explaining how I deal with compassion fatigue, because it's not something that I, and I don't mean this in a bad, I don't really know how to express it. It's not something that I think of in the forefront, if that makes sense. I hear people talking about it and I understand what others are feeling. And, you know, I think maybe sometimes that comes out as potentially stress or anxiety, but not necessarily always as fatigue. And some of that may just be because I have, you know, been privileged enough to work in places where we do, you know, you're able to get a break when you need one, right? And you're truly like not quote unquote burned out, you know, as you need to be. And I think burnout obviously looks different for all sorts of people at different stages. And, you know, just even being able to have the capacity to just go to the gym, you know, when you need to go to the gym, or, you know, just get outside, or, you know, have time to go play with your dog during daylight hours, which is a struggle anywhere up north, right? You know, I think just being able to have that out, and just, again, coming back to having the self-awareness to realizing when you need to take a break, and helps you, one, compartmentalize things, but not in a negative way, just in a way that, you know, work is work. And if you have great outcomes, great. And if you don't, you know, what lessons can you learn from it and move forward?
That says a lot about Fairfield and the work environment, because that's not everywhere. What makes Fairfield such a great place to work? I know you have access to a lot of great medicine and great people. Is that kind of what it is? Or
Yeah.
You
know, when I reflect back over places that I worked, I don't think I ever made any of the choices I did. I mean, I obviously made choices purposefully, but I realize I have always liked places that have a great culture. So, right. So I went to Texas A&M, has an amazing culture, you know, has a lot of people who feel very strongly about, you know, being from there and what that means and that community. And then, you know, ended up doing my residency at Penn, which also has a very strong culture. And I would like to note that I have not said Penn we once during this so far.
I was about to go there. Yeah. Good job.
And, you know,
you may, if you wish, do you just want to get it out of your system and say,
I haven't done it yet. You know, I went there, I drank the Kool-Aid. I loved that community there and everything about that.
Yeah.
And feel like I truly loved my residency, which I don't think everybody, you know, is lucky enough to be able to say that. But I love the people there, and what, you know, we're able to accomplish there on a daily basis. And so Fairfield has just kind of been the natural next step with that. You know, it's a practice that has a great sense of community, and, you know, they've have a long line of training, excellent doctors who've gone on to do incredible things. And even if they aren't working at the practice, you know, there are referring veterinarians, there are friends, you know, there are people we still get to interact with every day. And that's part of what I love, honestly, about being a surgeon. You know, when you're a general practitioner, you know, and as an equine vet, you know, your clients are your clients, right? And you have great relationships with them. But as a surgeon, I have clients, but then half my clients are referring vets, which for me is great, because then it's talking peer to peer with people every day, which I love. And so Fairfield has a great community of referring veterinarians. And I really love that, because they all, you know, really respect the practice and what we do here. And obviously, you know, especially as a specialist, you don't get to do anything really without the referring vet's consent. And so it's great, you know, to be able to work somewhere that has a good reputation. So that way, you know, people trust the practice, and then they, you know, again, for someone who's barely been here for a year, you know, they put a lot of trust in me because of who I'm associated with, and, you know, who I was associated with before here. So that's really great to be a part of that community and that network.
Well, there's definitely a job security in being a surgeon, right? I mean, if you're in a good place and you're a surgeon, people referring to you, it seems like a good place to be compared to.
I mean, the job security is just in that horses are horses. Inevitably. They're going to find a way. And even if horses aren't wanting to be horses, luckily enough in the Northeast, the weather changes enough, you know, that helps us out a little bit.
Yeah. So what percentage are colic surgeries of what you do?
Over, I would say from an emergency standpoint, it's probably the number one emergency surgery that we perform. You know, after that, it's things like lacerations, septic joints. But it's, I think, first and foremost, colic surgeries in this neck of the woods. What contributes to the overall practice, I would maybe say is like 10 or 15%.
And what's your most difficult surgery where you get out of it and you're like, I'm amazing. I can't believe I just did that.
That's a great question. I would say, each arthroscopy is a little different, right? Things that are considered more challenging arthroscopies is like, so when we talk about the stifle joint, there's baseline, basic stifle joint arthroscopies where there's just tiny bone fragments that we're going after. And then there's more complicated soft tissue injuries where we're going into, what we say is the back of the joint. Those can sometimes be challenging. Shoulder arthroscopy can be challenging, but it's very fun and rewarding when it works out. But today we removed a basketball-sized tumor off of a horse that's like adhered to its jugular vein and it's carotid and it's in an area with a lot of very important things and it's a very big tumor.
Wow.
And that, required a huge team effort to be able to accomplish successfully today. So it's cool. Every day is a little different and sometimes straightforward things turn into something really challenging and sometimes challenging things, end up pretty easy.
And you have some diagnostics that are, there's certain machines that can only be in a certain region, they actually have a territory. And yeah, so tell me about that. And aren't you getting a new one in a whole new building? A
couple new ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're throwing some softballs here. So we... a standing Hallmark MRI. So that's an MRI or a magnet that the horse is able to walk up into and put their foot inside. And, you technically can scan up towards, the hock or the tarsus or the carpus or the knee and the forelimb. But the predominant thing that you do with a standing MRI is foot, a pastern or a fetlocks or a distal limb there. And that requires a horse to be sedated. And sometimes those scans take several hours, but they're excellent for, imaging soft tissue structures of the foot. The other imaging modality that we have here is what's called nuclear scintigraphy. So that's a bone scan. So that's where the horse is injected with a radioactive isotope that is meant to bind to increased areas of bone turnover. And you can scan parts of the horse, you can scan the whole horse. So we have the ability to facilitate that. And what we're planning on getting this spring is what's called a PET scanner. So the PET stands for positron emission tomography. So essentially the easiest way to think of it is like a three-dimensional bone scan that goes just on the distal limb. So again, carpus down or tarsus down. And so it's looking at bony activity within the distal limb, but as opposed to a bone scan that just is looking at this and creating an image that's two-dimensional and printed out, on a screen, the PET scan is able to acquire this and put together a three-dimensional image. So you have better what we call spatial resolution, meaning that, you can see exactly what you're not just like, oh, it's like hot per se in the fetlock, but it's like hot on, the front and the outside portion of the fetlock, which is really cool. And that imaging is able to be then overlaid onto another image to help demonstrate to owners and trainers, where exactly the pathology is. So you can put that on top of an MRI, you can put that on top of a CT. And so, yeah, that little building that we mentioned. So we do have a CT now that's able to facilitate CTs of, the distal limb for horses under anesthesia. So it's a small portable machine that we're able to use in our OR, which is great, for fracture repair or helping aim screws across small cysts within the foot, which is great. But there's other units out there that are larger that are able to acquire CT standing. And so we are working on making a new building that's going to have, a new OR for horses under general anesthesia, a standing OR. And then we'll put in what's called the Calibra CT. So that's the company that works with Canon to build a special platform for the CT. So that way horses can have, their head or their distal limbs acquired within the CT while they're standing, or you can anesthetize the horse and CT, we can almost fit the whole horse in the CT now. We're able to CT horses down to their chest. You're able to CT the pelvis. and the hind limbs. So, you know, it's phenomenal just what we've been able to expand from a diagnostic standpoint with horses now, with things that, you know, aren't just accessible, but are fast and are safe. That, you know, even 10, 15 years ago was something like, even when I was going through vet school, like, you know, PET and standing CT were not things that we commonly talked about. And, you know, these are technologies and modalities that students are exposed to even, you know, at their university. So it's crazy how much is out there and just how quickly, you know, we're discovering all these new things.
What are your pet peeves about horse owners and living in the Northeast? I've lived in Mass. I've lived in New Hampshire. You just see these big boarding facilities. You know, my pet peeve is the horses get no turnout. They live in a box. You know, it's a dusty environment. They're stressed out. They're not living out in pastures. At my farm, I only have 3 horses. It's not a boarding facility, but they have the stall. They have the overhang. Then they can go out in the paddock, and it's always open. They do whatever they want. So that's my pet peeve for the Northeast that I see a lot. And I'm like, oh, that's so sad that that horse gets 2 hours of turnout in a dirt paddock. Do you have some ideas or things that are pet peeves with that horse owners do or don't do that you wish they would change?
For the official record, I have no pet peeves. I love all of our owners.
Excellent answer. Excellent.
You are flawless and perfect in every way.
Perfect. Let's move on.
You're not going to listen to this.
Question.
I can listen to
this. Real talk, I think I am not unique, like I'm the only person who gets to see this, but I think vets get to see horse owners from every discipline, whereas, you know, people who only compete in one discipline. And I do get sad. It's not necessarily pet peeve. I just get sad when people make generalizations about other disciplines or think that certain disciplines treat horses more poorly. Mm-hmm. Because I think, honestly, I know there's bad apples in every bunch, and having seen every discipline and bunch, like, I know there are bad apples in every bunch, but, like, so many of the people who are in this are genuinely in this industry and profession, especially if you're a professional, because you love horses. And, you know, most of these people are people who grew up with the industry, or if they didn't grow up with the industry, they became involved super young, and they made this a lifelong passion of theirs. And so I just hate when, you know, people try to throw somebody else under the bus in a different discipline that they're not a part of, because, you know, I think there's really great people all around the world who are out there just trying to do the best for themselves and for the horses and trying to help us all out. So I wish everybody got to see that perspective.
Yeah. And it's a hard life. Just for a short period of time, I was working in Maryland at a boarding facility, a hunter jumper barn. And it took like an hour a day, was just turning out and everything, but it snowed 26 inches. And so here I am living in a trailer behind the barn so that I could do night check. They had me right where they wanted me. I wasn't getting paid anything. I didn't have any health insurance, but it snowed 26 inches and they put me on the roof with a cable and, you know, hooked up rappelling so that I could shovel snow on a roof to prevent it from collapsing. There were other workers on the tractor bucket being like lifted up to the edge so they could shovel. So it's like, these are the kind of situations we put ourselves in as horse people. So yeah, it's definitely a passion, and it's kind of a little bit of a craziness. You know, how can we understand why do people do the things that they do? But
love knows no boundaries.
We are crazy. It's okay. I'll self-proclaim it. Like, it's like, we work with 1,200 pound suicidal animals on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And think we can tame them for the most part. You know, they'll always surprise you enough. And the day you get comfortable is usually the day you get hurt. So
that's why it's magical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's, yeah, your natural horsemanship background, that's huge. Do you ever have a situation where the horse just won't load and you're like, hey, I got this.
John Lyons this. Let's go.
No, because usually if I try to help, then most people who are involved with the loading process think I know nothing about loading, and I will just let them think that. It's like, okay, that's great. You can, if you want to hang out in the parking lot for 6 hours to load your horse, that's, go for it. And if you want them to stay another night, you can. And this is with the hospitalization rate.
Yeah.
How tempted do you think veterinarians are on a daily basis to say the words, we could do this the easy way, or we could do this the hard way?
Yeah, that's a daily thing.
Yeah.
Well, you can charge for the hard way.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
Yeah.
Hard way is also more expensive.
This is great. Thank you for talking to us today. I just have one more question, and it's kind of, where do you see the equine medicine industry headed? There's less and less equine vets. People are switching over to the small animal world for the hours, for the pay, you know, and as we just talked about, equine people, horse people are nuts. There's going to be equine vets anyways, no matter what. But where do you kind of see it heading? And where do you think we'll be like in 10 years? How will things be different?
I'm erring on the positive side of things, unfortunately, like as a cautious optimist, I guess. You know, the people who are in this industry are genuinely good people, and I think that's going to continue. I'm not saying people who come in and leave aren't good people. You know, I have several excellent friends who I love dearly who started out in equine who are now doing other things, but I think that worked out for them and how their life was going to proceed. So I don't judge anybody, you know, who was in it and then not in it. And I think some people end up returning back eventually, which is great. So I think we're always going to have good people. And as long as that happens, you know, I think the industry is going to be solid. And we're going to continue, you know, we're continuing to have more specialized practice, which I think is good. You know, I think everyone still has to be open to the idea of the spectrum of care. And, you know, I also understand, you know, the kind of medicine we're able to perform here is not the same as, you know, what I can deliver out in Wyoming or, you know, out in, you know, rural Colorado, right? And at the end of the day, you still have people where your horse is your livelihood. And you know, how you're able to make money, not as like a professional horse trainer, but just, you know, like working cattle and like taking care of your ranch, and things are, I think, are going to continue to evolve because of the costs associated with having horses. But that's just, unfortunately, something we're seeing with agriculture as a whole. You know, we're in the Northeast, and our small dairy farms are also, unfortunately, going by the wayside. So sorry, just to kind of, I think it's all interconnected in that, you know, I think a lot of smaller operations are going to struggle potentially, and some I think will do okay, and we're all going to have to find our way through it. But I do think that, you know, the industry is heading in a great direction. You know, we're able to diagnose things more accurately. So, and I think especially when we're looking at the performance horse and the athletic horse, I think things are looking great because, you know, we're able to prevent injuries. We're able to determine better when horses are at the right point in recovering from injury and able to go back up and really step up their training. And I think that's, you know, kind of been something that's been a hidden piece of the puzzle that we now have access to with all of our advanced imaging modalities. And people within this industry are very collegial and I think, you know, open to sharing cases. And that really makes for having the beehive and the hive mind, as they say, approaching things and everybody sharing their experiences. So, I'm cautiously optimistic about it. You know, in terms of helping students find their way into the industry, it's a hard line of work to go for. It's definitely not for everyone, but also like being an NBA basketball player isn't for everyone. So, you know, those who find their way into it, I think will succeed. If they want to.
Yeah. Your passion and your knowledge are inspiring. And that, like, to see somebody like you who just entered into it and have the drive that you have and you know, the obviously the fondness you have for it is really, it's truly inspiring. It is. So thank you.
Yeah. And you just had such a positive take on the veterinary industry and what they're doing for horses. You're saying the welfare is going to get better because of the things you're able to do for horses, you know, diagnosing, recovery, things like that. When the rest of the non-horse world thinks it's going, it's, you know, all these things are detrimental to horses. I just think it's interesting just that the job of an equine vet is horse welfare. But, you know, just like you said, your perspective of it's getting better, you were able to do more. And I think more non-horse people need to hear that perspective, as opposed to what they see.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all about the narrative, right? And like who's, what we're putting out there. And this is why what you guys are doing is great, right? You know, you guys are out there trying to, you know, bring people together and share stories. I think the more we can get positive narratives within the vet industry as a whole, and specifically within equine, then the more opportunities there are for people to realize what it's actually like out there.
Agreed.
Awesome. So we need to listen to Daylist on Spotify.
So like your Daylist Spotify,
yeah.
Spotify curating what you listen to based on the time of day.
Can you share one of your Daylists with us and then we can post it somewhere and then we can all listen to Dr.
Post it on the notes.
Yeah, just from one day.
So see, yeah. I'm going to have to like give it a couple days then and wait, and we're going to have to see.
You're going to have to purge the playlist.
Exactly. We're going to have to like start over. And then that way we just get all the pop punk emo on gear.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The best is whenever you're sharing it, like when one of your friends posts one of theirs and they'll pop up and they're like, oh, today I have small town coastal cowgirl. And you're like, I also have small town coastal. Like, what does that even mean? Cowgirls are living on the coast here. Maybe an
we're gonna find you and follow you on Spotify so we can partake in like a listening session.
Exactly.
While you're doing surgery.
Yeah. That's actually great. Yeah, that would be true. That'd be fun.
Yeah, yeah.
We have to create the community. That's what it's all about.
That's right.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, this was a lot of fun.
Agreed.
I really
thank you guys.
It.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Our pleasure. Seriously. Yeah.
I think a lot of people will enjoy listening to your perspective and your story.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, it was good getting to see you guys.
Yeah. Which conferences are you going to this year?
This year? Ooh, Roland and I were just talking about this on the calendar.
Because you have to do like rock, paper, scissors, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. So he really likes to go to AAP because he likes to help recruit the interns. And AAP is a great place to do that. I like to go to ACVS because I like to nerd out with all the other surgeons. So I think those are the two that are set in stone. Like he'll be at AAP, I'll go to ACBF. There's a organization that is essentially like the Association of Osteosynthesis. So like in fancy words for, you know, the equine fracture or the vet fracture kids. So they'll do a course in the fall that I'll go to. And then actually the Calibra folks who, you know, that's the company that we'll get our CT with. They're doing a summit in Fort Collins this fall, so we'll likely head out to that too. So,
awesome!
Yeah,
a lot of fun.
Thank you, guys. Have a
good day. Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, man, that was fun.
I know that was a great interview. I'm very impressed with how eloquently and articulately she represented herself.
There's no like what I do all the time.
Yeah,
it was more like matter of fact. Yep.
Yeah.
Very well spoken.
Agreed. Yeah, you know, and the passion's there. You can just see it and everything she talks about, and that's really cool. Yeah.
Then just the maturity for her age to understand the communication with her team and her place in that.
Yeah.
Her responsibility.
Yeah.
Very mature.
Agreed. And I expect big things. I think she has a very bright future.
Yeah, there's just something about having a positive outlook on life.
Yeah.
Combine that with competitive adventure seeking.
Yeah.
That makes the perfect surgeon, right?
Right.
I could just see her playing Top Gun. I think like her dad probably used to play that all the time.
For sure. That definitely happened.
That's like her favorite.
He probably called her Maverick.
Cheers to you, Dr. Crandall.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Crandall.
What a pleasure. Do you have feedback? Community is the primary mission of the podcast. Do you have a comment or suggestion from an episode? For an opportunity to be featured, please record your feedback on our website's feedback sidebar button. You can record up to 5 minutes. For more about Velio Mentis, go to veliomentis.com. Find us on Facebook and Instagram. If you want to support this project, please click on the Patreon link in the show notes. If you enjoyed, please subscribe, rate, and review. Thank you.